Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. When it comes to healthcare, the price of exclusion is staggering and all too often fatal. Less than 6% of American doctors identify as Black or African American. At the same time, census figures show that Black people account for about 14% of the total U.S. population. And the number of Black doctors has barely budged in the past 100 years. As for the staggering price, experts point to the disparity between Black doctors and Black patients as a primary reason for the dramatic differences in health outcomes between Black people and white people. Consider the following. Black Americans fare significantly worse than their white peers when it comes to high blood pressure, heart disease, strokes, asthma, and maternal and infant mortality, to cite just a few obvious examples. Their life expectancy lags that of whites by almost 5 years. Here in North Carolina, Shaw University was the site of the nation's first four-year medical school. It closed in 1918, but not before training more than 400 Black doctors. In some ways, we have made little progress since. Journalist Nicole Carr spent the past few years delving into the roots of these medical disparities and what it's costing all of us. She joins me today to discuss her new book. It's called The Price of Exclusion: The Pursuit of Healthcare in a Segregated Nation. Nicole Carr, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you so much, Eric. I'm glad to be here.
So let's begin with what inspired you to go down this road. You have long covered stories about discrimination and racial injustice, and this book fits into that narrative without a doubt. But you also examine this from a personal family history perspective, as embodied by your great-grandfather, Dr. Lawrence St. Clair Ferguson. What is his story, and how does he figure into the larger history?
Sure. So my great-grandfather was born in Trelawney, Jamaica in 1893. And our family didn't know a whole lot about Dr. Ferguson because, as you'll read in the book, I take this journey with my father. This is his biological grandfather. And our family had been split by a kind of nasty divorce between the doctor's son and my grandmother. And we carried the Ferguson name, but we didn't talk about the Fergusons too much. I'd heard growing up that, your great-grandfather went to Howard University because my grandparents resided in Washington, D.C., in that area. And every time we'd visit, my grandmother would remind me that, we had a family member who'd gone to Howard, and that was really the extent of it. There was a funeral, the man I knew to be my grandfather, his funeral, where a Ferguson family member showed up, a cousin, and she brought a photo of this plaque in the Port Antonio, Jamaica hospital to the funeral. And she said, did you know this plaque was up for your great-grandfather? And so I kind of tucked that in my back pocket, had never seen it. That was in 2018. Fast forward to 2020, we're on lockdown. During the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I was working in local television here in Atlanta. When we locked down, I was 4 months postpartum with our third child. So we have three children. I had a kindergartner in a dual language immersion program online. I had a third grader online, and we have a newborn that I'm nursing while my husband is running the camera in the garage on our makeshift set for live television. And, we were all going through it. Whatever your setup was when we were on lockdown, we had these moments of really despair. I think in the beginning, we said, we'll get over this. We had our picnics outside and even these were points of privilege, how comfortable you were being locked down in your home. Well, one night I I got off the 11 o'clock show. We were running 6 to 10 minute investigations on access to testing, what was happening with, you know, just anything you could imagine having to do with how we survived COVID. We were covering this on the evening news. I was so tired one night. And really, quite frankly, depressed. And maybe this had to do with postpartum at the time. But I asked myself, how the heck did they get through this 100 years ago? And I was thinking about the Spanish flu pandemic. That's when that plaque came to mind.
And of your great-grandfather.
Right, that was in the hospital. And I said, wasn't he practicing around that time? Or what, you know, what is someone born, you know, in the 1890s doing in 1918? And so I took the name on the plaque. It didn't even have his full name written out, but I took that and I went to Howard's website and started going through the archives. The Mellon Foundation had just helped Howard to digitize many of its archival assets. And it just so happened that his 1925 med school yearbook, The Morgue, had been digitized. So I saw his young face for the first time, like in the middle of the night during COVID, read about him fighting in the British West Indies Regiment and where he was at the height of Spanish flu pandemic, which was in the war, landing in America during Red Summer. To a very segregated America, this fight for democracy, this racial reckoning. We were going through the same thing in 2020. And I just started kind of peeling back.
So you were down the rabbit hole at that point.
I was down the rabbit hole. I couldn't sleep. You know, it seemed like.
And what a great diversion from all the stress that you're going through in your life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then I became obsessed and I started sharing it, you know. We were on Zooms and phone calls with family and friends, and I started sharing this information with my family, but also my agent, Tracy Wilkes Smith, who was working with me in a, you know, the capacity of being a journalist agent. I'm just on the phone with her. I'm like, you won't believe what I found. And she said, you should write a book. And that's how it started. I didn't intend to write the book, but I saw so many parallels that were, you know, helping me to understand the moment and understand that every generation faces similar challenges, and how we approach those challenges really depends on how fortified we are with information. I always think history is our guide. Like if we can understand how we've survived, thrived, been challenged, then we can think about the problems before us a little differently. And so that's how it started. I, you know, had no intentions on writing a book, but it made sense.
So. That's the voice of Nicole Carr. She is here talking to us about The Price of Exclusion. It's her new book. And so much of your book is about systemic racism. And as you say, there are all too many parallels between the present and the past. I have to admit, I was painfully naive on this topic in that typically I would think of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, for lack of a better term, the horror of that, the way that patients are treated differently, and we know discriminated against for many, many years. I had really never thought about the doctor side of it, which, of course, is what your book is about. And I'm curious... share with us a little bit of the ways that discrimination crept into either students getting into medical school or finishing medical school.
Absolutely. I mean, so I'm from North Carolina. I'm really glad to be with you all. I'm a military brat, Army brat from Fayetteville.
Well, welcome back home.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And so I have an aunt and uncle who went to Shaw University. Well, a couple of aunts and an uncle who went to Shaw. And another one of those pandemic era phone calls where, you know, you find yourself on the phone for an hour or two just talking. My uncle, Ted Johnson, who lives in Raleigh, was like, well, you know, Shaw had this medical school and a lot of people don't know about the medical school. And I was surprised that I did not know that. I don't know why I didn't know that. It just had never, I'd never reported around it. I didn't know the history of Shaw. I went to Winston-Salem State. I can tell you
go all Rams.
Go Rams. I can tell you all kinds of history around our alums, around the institution, around the founders. And I just had never been taught about Shaw. And so when he said that, you know, I mentioned it at the time I was working at ProPublica and we were talking about different projects. And I was like, I would love to report around the onset of medical education. I was like, did you know the first 4-year medical school in the entire US was at a Black college? And I, you know, I had an editor ask, do you mean first Black medical school? And then the folks who knew about Black medical schools assumed Howard or Meharry were the first, but Howard and Meharry are the ones that survive. And when I talk about surviving, you know, early 20th century, by the time the Flexner Report, which is commissioned by the American Medical Association and the Carnegie Foundation to evaluate the efficiency and the quality of medical schools in North America at the top of the 20th century, by the time they finished dissolving many of these schools for not being able to meet, quite frankly, criteria that would have been impossible for any Black school in these decades post-emancipation to meet.
In other words, they were doing this on purpose to run the medical schools out.
Run them out. And also this idea of what was quality. So here, you know, if we think about medical education, and this is really important now, I know Yale is in the news. I know we're looking at all the anti-DEI mm-hmm. measures and the ways that scholarships are being cut out, or the federal government, the Ed Department is going after institutions for supposed, you know, reverse racism. If you understand the history of how these schools come to be, how these scholarships come to be, how these places are defunded, today's arguments really make no common sense if you take the facts of it. So in the Flexner Report, a wholly unqualified evaluator, meaning someone who had never stepped foot in a medical school, Abraham Flexner is no expert in medical studies. He's got some friends, including Vanderbilt's president and some folks from Carnegie, and he's got ideas about how education should be reformed. But he comes through and he's got this criteria, and I'll give you one of the criterion. You know, the institution should have a $600,000 endowment. How in the world would a historically Black college in the couple of decades post-emancipation, and remember Shaw's medical school, Leonard Medical School, opens in the 1870s. I mean,
how would they have a nickel? Yeah, how would they have a nickel?
Some of your students are formerly enslaved. These aren't a bunch of freeborn, you know, students. So how would they have that? And that translates into equipment, into resources, but they were still serving the community.
We are going to leave a little cliffhanger there before we have Nicole Carr pick up the story again. Her new book is called The Price of Exclusion, The Pursuit of Healthcare in a Segregated Nation. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. You're listening to Charlotte Talks. Stay with us for more on healthcare and disparities. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is Nicole Carr. She is a journalist, and she is the author of the new book, The Price of Exclusion, The Pursuit of Healthcare in a Segregated Nation. And Nicole, when we went to the break, you were talking about this Flexner Report, named for Abraham Flexner, who, as you said, was not so much a medical expert as, for lack of a better term, a hatchet man who came in to close down a lot of Black medical schools.
Yes. And he's also gone through Canada at the time. And this ties back to my great grandfather because there was a ban on Black medical students in Canada at the time. It had to do with white women who didn't want Black attendees bedside. And so they weren't able to finish their programs there. And actually those schools thought that if they eliminated the Black student population, and many of those Black students were West Indian, they were coming from the Caribbean, that they could fare better on Flexner's report. And in fact, some of them did have higher evaluations once this ban went into place. And so it didn't necessarily have to aim to shut down just the Black medical schools, but it's kind of got you thinking about this anti-DEI movement right now. At least it had me in that space. And so Flexner goes through and, you know, he is saying that, look, there do need to be some Black physicians, you know, mm-hmm. because the race, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, mm-hmm. the race should take care of the race. And if you don't want Black people to spread disease to white people, then you'll leave some men of the race, men and women of the race, to be trained in this way. Another thing that's important about that is, you know, a lot of people ask me once they find out Shaw is the site of the first mm-hmm. Black medical school in the U.S., the next question is why? Well, the thinking behind this, and this is all in the archives from the Baptist Home Society that I come across at Mercer University mm-hmm. here in Atlanta. The idea is that, hey, we can try this, we can experiment, and we do need to do this. The Baptists are saying this is worthwhile. But if you are to train the Negro in medicine, you ought to make him go to school longer to prove himself as intelligent as the white man. 1870s, we're talking about standard medical education being a two-year apprenticeship or 3 years, a rigorous three-year program if you're talking your Ivy Leagues, Johns Hopkins, Harvard, Yale, Penn. They had not come to the four-year program. Johns Hopkins was considering it at the time, but their consideration was considered innovation. That we'll expand this program and we'll innovate in these ways. For Black people, it was considered necessary to prove yourself, just like prove yourself intelligent enough or worthy enough to vote, mm-hmm. own land, poll tax. Guess how many jelly beans are in this jar? Well, medical school is no different. So you think you can do this? Then go to school longer. Well, what happens, and this is incredibly important to North Carolina history, is that once these men and women graduate Leonard Medical School, and there are a handful of women coming through, mostly men, they have influence in a way that turns into political power. So your Leonard Medical School grads are going to go on to build the city of Durham. They're going to go on to be ambassadors to different African nations. They're going on to build hospitals in Charlotte. I mentioned one doctor.
Dr. John Taylor Williams, you mentioned, practiced at Good Samaritan Hospital.
Exactly. They go on to build insurance companies, banks. In Raleigh, you have your first Black mayoral candidate, graduate from Leonard. And because of the influence and the threat of him winning this election, Raleigh, that's how you get some of your first voter disenfranchisement laws in the city of Raleigh. And so the threat of the Black doctor is not so much what he or she will do within the hospital or to care for people. And white people want Black people healthy to an extent because they need them to labor. This is the other thing. We don't want, and this is the reasoning
awful,
behind.
Awful as it is, that is absolutely the truth.
This is how they're kind of considering the benefit of the medical school, but hey, don't give them anything. You've got to have, you know, the word merit comes up. Mm-hmm. Hear that a lot today. But that's not where they become dangerous. They become political and social powerhouses. And they also, they have the trust of the community. They're influential, and they're beginning to build wealth. And so I wrote about how one of the first casualties in Tulsa after the race massacre, the week that my great-grandfather is graduating pre-med studies at Howard, one of the first casualties in the massacre is a Black physician. And they're unaware of this as they're sitting in their caps and gowns and going through commencement, and the commencement speaker is telling them, you are the new Negro, you are going to save your people. And as long as you do this thing, you will show your worth to America, as if we needed to show our worth to America, to a nation that we built. And so what, but even that status, that education, that standing in the community does not save that physician in Tulsa from being murdered. You know, and so these are really important to get to know people. It's one thing to talk about health disparities and the trust that we have in our physicians and how race and socioeconomics all play a part in this. It's another to bring people alive.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because you do that so well in this book. And so it's not... While you have the policy and the statistics and all those things that matter and ground it in fact, the fact that you have these personalities, people that you come to know, like your great-grandfather, like Dr. John Taylor Williams, who I just mentioned, and many others, and you sort of, not sort of, you trace them. You go to Washington, and you go to Atlanta, and you come to North Carolina, and you see all the places where these people lived and tried to make a difference. I want to ask you a sort of a small subplot here when we're talking about Dr. Williams in particular, because he's a Charlotte, Mecklenburg County guy. Good Samaritan Hospital, as you probably know, was the first Black care institution here in Charlotte. And do you happen to know what sits on that spot right now?
What is that? I did not journey to Charlotte.
That is the home of the NFL Carolina Panthers. I think the hospital is somewhere around midfield, something like that. So, incredible history. Also, that was the site of, I think, the only recorded lynching in the city's history. So you have this horrible side to it, and, of course, a happier side now. As you're talking about Shaw University and the medical school, you also, in the book, detail how North Carolina figured prominently into the civil rights movement and hospital desegregation with a case in the 1960s, Simpkins versus Cone Memorial. What was the basis for the legal victory that it ended in?
So I think before you get to Simpkins in Greensboro, you have to get to this Eaton case and
in Wilmington.
Yes, in Wilmington, in the James Walker Memorial Hospital. That kicks off in 1956, which is the year my mother is born. And I remember my mom saying, I didn't understand this growing up, but she said, you know, me and Sandra, we were born in a hospital, talking about her sister. And I'm like, yeah, okay. She was saying, being among the youngest and coming along in the late 50s, my grandmother delivered in the hospital. Everyone else was
which was atypical.
Right. And she also recalls her father dying in where he was, in the basement of the integrated hospital in South Carolina. So you didn't want to go to the hospital, you know. But anyhow, the Eaton case, Hubert Eaton is interesting because he's married into a family. His father-in-law and his father, they're products of Leonard and I believe Meharry. So there's this Leonard case here. Eaton goes to Johnson C. Smith University. And the way that he is able to go to medical school up north in Michigan is because he is making a separate but equal argument. And this is very important because, not to out anyone, but there are some librarians, some archivists who made mention that, oh, North Carolina even paid for his education. Not because they were being generous. It was because there was no longer a medical school for Negroes in North Carolina. So if you can't provide that to me, then you must make a way for me to go to, you know, and get an equal, you know, quality education. So that's how he ends up being the only Black physician in his med school class. In 56, now Eaton has taken on New Hanover County school systems and helped desegregate the school system. He's taken on the Y. He's taking on everything you can imagine at New Hanover County. When he gets to the hospital, this ends up being a 10-year case. Because the courts are kicking this back as a local matter, or is this really about qualifications and merit and not discrimination? I mean, there's anything you can think of. This case keeps getting kicked back. The Simpkins case and Moses Cohn, and George Simpkins is a dentist. Mm-hmm. And he's got patients at his hospital who are lining the floor while Moses Cohn has open beds. They're saying we have beds, but they're saying you cannot come over.
That's the White Hospital.
That's the White Hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's still there. You know, this right. is, and I,
at yeah, the time, so, yes.
It, right. So Moses Cohn is like, yeah, we have beds. You can't come over here. And he's fighting to get, you know, to be able to play on the golf course in a neighborhood that's been redlined and, you know, 40 is running right through it today. And Simpkins is like taking on that case. And then he calls up the LDF, NAACP, and he's like, look, this is happening. This can't stand. The ways that they ultimately land victories in these desegregation cases over a decade is they say, make two points. One, you can't discriminate with federal dollars. You can't get, and this is, you know, as we're trying to build up these hospitals in post-World War II, we're trying to, you know, these hospitals, private or public, want these federal dollars to do this. So Adam Clayton Powell and Powell amendments and, you know, what he's telling President Kennedy, like, look, this is how, fine, you want to fund these places? Well, this is what you have to do to meet the standard for funding. But you know, places would hide their discrimination, or when inspectors would come, they would act like they weren't discriminating and they were. The other way that they win these cases is the patients join as plaintiffs and they say, because you won't allow my physician in the facility, I now don't have access to care because I have to have the Negro physician who can practice in this way because of the social rules, the construct you've set up. So if you block my access, if my physician is blocked from access to the facilities to treat me, this is now like state sanctioned killing.
Yeah.
Like you're making it impossible for me to get care. And so it's a lot of these different ways of attacking this argument about discrimination that takes, you know, well over a decade for there to be a victory. And of course, we cross over the Civil Rights Act and continue to investigate these claims well into the 70s and 80s.
I'm curious how much of the, I'll be honest, so much of this was new to me that I did not know. Again, I knew a little bit on the patient side, really mm-hmm. nothing on the medical school side. For you, who you've spent your career covering racial discrimination, all the inequities that we have in our country and have had in our country for hundreds of years, how much of this was new to you or surprising mm-hmm. to you?
None of it surprising, quite a bit of it new to me. I would not say I'm a healthcare reporter, that this was my beat. It is truly examining different systems through race, democracy. And while I was writing the book, I was also covering the parental rights movement for ProPublica. Mm-hmm. And so in 2021, I was very familiar with what was to come in terms of higher ed and the federal government and the anti-DEI movement. And I've written about this like within the past year as a analysis. I've said that the school board was a testing ground for the fall of democracy. Makes perfect sense. I tell people all the time, public schooling is the one system that most of us will come through in our lifetime. If you're going to shape an electorate, if you're going to shape a country and its values, you're going to the schoolhouse. That's why access to the schoolhouse has always been a political thing, you know? So when I hear about school voucher movements, the first thing I'm, you know, looking for is like what populations are benefiting and where are they going and where is money going. A voucher system is essentially how we get segregationist academies.
Antennae go up as soon as you hear that.
Right. So my antennas were up. So I wasn't surprised by this. What I was surprised by was how we walk past these institutions. I've walked around Shaw's campus a million times, never thought about the medical school, even though there is a historical marker there. The first public hospital in the United States for Black people is here in Georgia. It's in Savannah. But the way that our historical marker and the state of Georgia tell this history is very romantic. It's that it's basically suggesting that we were so progressive during enslavement that we were the first to open this hospital. When you go into the archives, you realize that the state fought the will of the man who willed this land for the hospital to be built. And the way that people buy into it, that white people buy into it, is they say, hey, look, enslaver, if you have the hospital, you don't have to keep sick property on your property. This becomes the public hospital for Black people becomes an insurance policy for the enslaver. When you put it in that context and you think about hospital or medical distrust today, or my grandfather not wanting to be taken to the hospital to go into the basement and all that, then you say, oh, the hospital was never a good place.
I think that's a good place to close before we take a quick break, because I want to get into that issue of trust and the damage that lingers into the present when we continue our conversation with Nicole Carr. Her new book is called The Price of Exclusion, The Pursuit of Healthcare in a Segregated Nation. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. You're listening to Charlotte Talks. Stay with us for much more with Nicole Carr. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is author Nicole Carr. Her book is called The Price of Exclusion, The Pursuit of Healthcare in a Segregated Nation. And before we get into how this damage lingers, I want to go back to something you were discussing, Nicole, and that is you were talking about the way the history is shared, how it's twisted. A lot of times it's invisible, or, you know, it's a plaque that's kind of tucked away in the corner. And as you were saying that, it reminded me of Bryan Stevenson. And he talks so often about how his work is aimed at putting that information in front of people so that they know. And he always draws a comparison to Germany and how when you're in Germany, there's no doubt of where an atrocity occurred, who committed the atrocity, and why we should take heed of that. And I'm curious whether you look at this book as a step in that direction.
Absolutely. I mean, I want to shout out one of my favorite authors in a book that I think ought to be required reading, Clint Smith's How the Word is Passed. I mean, the title says it all. When Clint is really in the field and reporting and confronting people on site and asking, listening to the way that they reckon with the history, depends on where you're from, how old you are, but really this is down racial lines here. Like, this plantation represents this and that. And so you really come to see how we glorify symbols of oppression. And it's not just the South. I mean, that's the one thing I wanted to make clear. There's a lot of the Caribbean here, but you also get a sense of the British and their relationship, you know, with their colonies and territory. You know, a lot of people or pre-readers have been saying, like, I didn't realize what the racism looked like there, because that's just not their lineage or their story. And, you know, in Jamaica, the kind of slogans, out of many one, and it's one love, and it's all of that. But even in the Caribbean, and I wrote some of this there, I was just thinking about their versions of CRT and the way that they reckon with how we come to be. And so you get this, you get a little bit of Canada. I'm talking about what's going on in Scotland. I'm talking about the British and the West Indians and here in America. And it's really like pick your place, right? And so we can see globally, just as a condition of humanity, what happens when we do not confront the ways that our nations are built and the caste systems, the ways that we shape power, because that's what racism is about. You must have a caste system, a power system, to put someone on the bottom and someone on the top. Race is our construct. And when you begin to just kind of peel the onion back and look at it in that way, you understand how people come to live here and why soil or water quality is like this here and not there. Why, you know, the book opens up in rural Georgia. I'm giving you a bleak picture by data, by census data and state data on physicians and hospital closure data. But had these people that I profile in the prologue, these Black people, had they lived a century ago, they probably would have better health outcomes because of the access to the hospital and who was running the hospital. And so I'm giving you a window into, look, 100 years ago, this lady I'm talking to today would have had a hospital a quarter mile from her house. There hasn't been one in the county for like two decades.
And given all of these societal factors that we're talking about, when you write about the American Medical Association, I think in 2008, apologizing, yeah. Mm-hmm. The Carnegie Foundation apologizing mm-hmm. formally for mm-hmm. furthering discrimination in medical schools, mm-hmm. it makes it all the more important to have that public recognition.
It does, but it also, Eric, makes you wonder how the arguments that are being made to cut out the programs and the funding that is meant to repair as best we can this damage that's been done, because there ends up being another acknowledgement from the AMA during COVID. And I covered that as a reporter, where it said, hey, the role we played in the Flexner report and all of that really cut into the physician supply today. So while we're talking to you all today about COVID and trust and the communities and all of this, like, we have to admit that we sanction this, and that it's, when you sanction these policies, they're generational. This is a long game. You can't say that was so long ago, get rid of it. If in Raleigh, North Carolina, at the time, we're producing more physicians than Meharry. Meharry is not the size it is today. Neither is Howard. So we're talking about a supply of Black physicians in the Southeast that really North Carolina was the hub. And how would that have changed our state and our development?
And one of the best examples, I think, that illustrates all of these things coming together, the lack of Black doctors, the effects of mistruth, misinformation, neglect in Black healthcare, is when you recount meeting a woman named Linda Adams, I think in your hometown of Atlanta. She mm-hmm. is at a community health clinic, and she encounters a 26-year-old Moorhead student named Shelby Ware. And why is this important to Linda Adams' health?
Linda Adams tells me at this community health fair that she would not have come out, that she comes out to have her vitals checked, to get some basic needs met right there in her backyard in the park, not far from Mercedes-Benz Stadium. She comes out here because she saw these Black medical students. And she said, I can go there and get it done. And they come to her. So think of them in the context of the clinic or the hospital. They set this up. They come to her, and she's got a level of trust with them. And then they're sharing their experiences in landing in medical school. By the way, Dr. Shelby Ware is now Dr. where. Oh, fantastic.
She made it. She made it.
She made it. And I should see her in LA on the LA stop. I read through her portion of the book with her about a year ago to make sure that I'd, you know, to fact check and make sure that I had retold her story well enough. But it worked both ways, the synergy between the patient and the doctor. And then I'm taking my kids there. I just dropped my kid off to get a flu shot from them so they could see these young Black medical students doing this. And now, you know, I have a daughter who is interested in healthcare now, who has expressed this. It is very important for you to see yourself in something that statistically you're not in.
Right. And you write about the lack of Black medical students, Black mm-hmm. doctors, Black medical schools. And I believe later this year, the first new Black medical school
yes.
to open in the 21st century will finally open. It's in New Orleans, Xavier yes. University. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so, tell us a little. I mean, it's obvious why this is important, but what might this do to help this?
This provides a space. We're still historically Black colleges and universities are still producing the majority of Black physicians, lawyers, engineers. You know, I'm thinking about A&T right now mm-hmm. too, and agriculture. Right, we're still producing the majority of the very few Black physicians that are out there. I don't know what this will mean, and I'm going to tell you why. We've got the big, beautiful bill. We've got July 1st coming up. We've got limits on loans. We've got the Ed Department determining what constitutes a profession worth pursuing. We've got legal attacks on, you know, for so-called discrimination to eliminate scholarships and opening the door. When you combine all of those things, I don't know if it's simply access to the physical institution that's going to carry us over the line or make up for this deficit. Because if the institution is not filled with the bodies,
right.
the people to learn, then none of this, I hate to sound like this, but really we have to think about what any of this means if we can't educate folks.
And you immersed yourself in this world of Black healthcare for the past couple of years. So you're speaking to a lot of students, you're speaking to a lot of Black doctors and nurses. I'm wondering what they're saying to you, how optimistic, pessimistic, neutral, we're generalizing here, but what did you hear of how severe the problem is and the chances of improving the current circumstances?
My most important review of all of them came from Dr. Uche Blackstock, and I don't have it in front of me, but she had expressed both in the review and separately that this narrative sat with her in a different way. She's the author of Legacy. She, you know, her twin sister and her mother are products of Harvard Med. Mm-hmm. And she talked about modern day experiences with fighting for health equity and also just powering through as a Black physician in these institutions and in the ways that, you know, patients view you and just all of the victories and the hurdles that Black physicians face. When she said that this sat with her differently, I realized that, no, I'm not in the healthcare space where my power is in the journalistic inquiry, the archives, the pulling this together and putting the people in their lives together in a way that, wow, this makes sense to me today. And so it was really important for physicians to take this in. The incoming AMA president graduated from Morehouse, Dr. Willie Underwood, and I saw him on campus and gave him an early copy. And he said, you're talking about things that a lot of these students don't know today. That, you know, we talk about this stuff. We know this, but they don't know this. I've spoken with folks at Morehouse School of Med, an older surgeon, he's got to be in his 80s, who's still on faculty here, who knew some people in the book, but also said, you know, we used to learn about Leonard. He was surprised that I had, you know, brought this, you know, to the surface. So, and then Dr. Ware told me, I didn't know any of this before I met you. Mm-hmm. Before I kind of stalked her and figured out who am I going to follow to, you know, illustrate.
She's the young woman I just mentioned that you.
Yes.
That mm-hmm. was at the clinic. Yes.
That was at the clinic and now is practicing in California. And I just, it was scary for me because, you know, there could be a lot of technical jargon mm-hmm. and lots of things. I wanted to make sure that I was speaking to the population that it's affected and also relaying what they're experiencing. Without trying to position myself as some kind of healthcare expert, mm-hmm. that I'm not, but the humanistic inquiry that is required for us to, again, confront the times and understand how we come to be, I think that is really the power in our journalism, is to document the times, but also to contextualize them. Mm-hmm. And we have to do that or else we're just stenographers for different sides of, quite frankly, a whole lot of chaos. Mm-hmm. And so people aren't, they're not seeing it. I mean, we're feeling our economy. We know what's going right and what's going wrong when it hits us. But you're like, how did we get here? This is exactly how we got here. And there are too many people who say, I don't do politics. Well, politics do you. Politics are based on policy. And if you don't understand how policy comes to be, and this even goes for the press. I mean, we're facing some things right now that are, you know, the results of some new policies coming up, the ways that we view freedom of speech, freedom of the press. We're political, whether we don't like to say that, but that's literally the definition of it, like the ways that we're shaped by policy.
Absolutely. As you think about this book now out in the world, as we come up toward the end, just a little bit of time left, what's one thing that you hope people who are maybe strangers to this topic or not real well-versed in it, that they might take away?
Well, one, I hope it's an easy read for you and that it touches your heart. And I say that because we've got to be able to feel to take care of one another. We absolutely can meet America's promise if we commit to taking care of one another. That's how you get to the harmony. Being divisive doesn't mean that you ignore the ways that we got here. Being divisive is, quite frankly, trying to act like these conditions are not in place and that policies aren't set forth to ensure that we have this standing in society. So I hope it touches people who believe that the past has nothing to do with the present, that people need to get over things. I hope you see the generational through lines. I hope you understand mindset because of how it was baked into education or what have you. And yeah, I hope it's an easy read that touches the heart.
Nicole Carr is the author of The Price of Exclusion, The Pursuit of Healthcare in a Segregated Nation. Nicole, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good luck with the book. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks so much for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.